We have been going through the book of John, but as we got to the trials of Jesus, there are some of the trials that John doesn't talk about. And so we're going to jump out of line a little bit and run over to Luke for the night to find out a little bit more about the trial before the Sanhedrin, because we don't want to leave these trials uncovered. And again, we want to be reminded, I know we probably remember, but want to make sure that we're reminded that there were six trials, and of course, they kind of ran from one into the other, so it wasn't like six separate days or anything. All of these trials took place in a period of time of about 12 hours. From the time that he was arrested in the garden that night, and we don't know the exact time, but we know it was before the night crowing of the rooster, so it was sometime in the nighttime hours, probably late into the evening, certainly after dark, but not until, not maybe quite bedtime because people were still up and about, but nonetheless, from that time until 9 o'clock the next morning when he was taken out to be crucified. So less than 12 hours that this all takes place. And yet it's jam-packed in there because he has these all-night trials and the Sanhedrin trial. If you want to turn to Luke 22, we'll be beginning in verse 66 and looking at that. The trial before the Sanhedrin was the final of the Jewish religious trials. He had already been to Annas, he'd already been to Caiaphas. And they had questioned him all through the night, and they had mocked him, they had spit upon him, they had done all of these things, blindfolded him and slapped him and said, "Who slapped you?" and all these things. And they'd done all of that through the night, questioned him, tried to find false witnesses, all of these things, all through the night. In Luke 22 and verse 66, then it says, "And as soon as it was day," so in other words, as soon as the sun was peaking over the skyline, you know, as soon as it started to rise, "the elders of the people and the chief priests and the scribes came together and led him into their council." So this is the formal trial. This is the one that attempts, and I'll say it attempts. It doesn't make a very good attempt at it, but it tries at least to act like this is a legitimate trial going on. Now, it itself was also illegal, but it at least tried to pretend that it was legal. Tried to give the air of this is an official, formal court hearing. The rule under Jewish law, not the law of Moses, but under their own law that they had made, their civil law, was that if someone was arrested and accused of a crime, the trial would not be held for at least 24 hours. To the following day was the rule. That was the law. Well, of course, they broke that. They took him, arrested him, and took him straight to trial that wasn't an official trial with someone who wasn't even the high priest presiding. Then they took him to the actual high priest, but not with all of the council there. So that it could be, again, kind of a secretive thing. And, of course, they had schemed all of this from the start. And then, when daylight came, they could pretend, okay, hey, it's new day. Now we can really have the trial. And so the whole council, the entire Sanhedrin council, came together. And I say entire. I'm sure there may have been one or so may have been absent. But in general, the council was together. And they came together to question him. Now, the reason this one was illegal was not just because of the timing of them not supposed to have the trial until the next day, but the timing of it was that it fell on a holy day. And they were never to hold trials on holy days. And yet this one was on a holy day. And so, which would have been the 14th of Nisan, most likely, which would have been the time of the Passover. It would have been part of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, part of the Passover feast. They would not have been legally having a trial on that day. And so as soon as the sun comes up, which, this morning the sun came up a little after 6:15 or so. It first started a little bit of daylight showing. So you're thinking early in the morning they would have been gathering together. And they then began to ask him questions. Verse 67 through 69, they say, "Are you the Christ? Tell us." And he said to them, "If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I also ask you, you will not answer me, nor will you let me go. Hereafter shall the Son of Man sit on the right hand of the power of God." Now, I wanted you to think about that for just a minute. Notice, he did not answer their question. He mentions the Son of God and the right hand of the power of God, but he never mentions the Son of God, which is what they asked him. They asked him, "Are you the Christ?" He never mentions that. He doesn't answer that, and he doesn't mention the Son of God. But notice then their response that we'll see in just a minute. But notice what's happening here. I mean, this has been going on since he was arrested. The same questions over and over again. They're just hounding him with the same thing. "Are you the Christ? Are you the King? Are you the Messiah? Are you saying you're the Son of God? Are you really? Is this who you really are?" They've been going over these questions again and again and again, all through the night. Now, we don't know everything that's happened over the past 7, 8, 9 hours. You know, if they arrested him at 9 o'clock, it's been 9 hours of this kind of stuff. Mocking him, questioning him, moving him from one place to another, questioning him again, all of these kinds of things, which would make for a long, tiring night. It's certainly not as rough as what the Romans are going to do to him when they get a hold of him. But it's made for a long, sleepless night and a troublesome night. But these three verses basically are a 10-second summary of what's happened during that 7, 8, or 9 hours, however long this has been going on. This is basically what's been going on over and over and over again. Now, we know that he is the Christ. We know he's been proclaimed the Christ. He's shown it with the miracles that he performed, with his ability to teach and talk about things that others didn't even know. So he's shown it again and again that it's unequivocally true that he is the Son of God, that he is the Christ, and they're asking him, but notice his response. Obviously, they're not terribly interested in the truth here, are they? Their whole purpose for having this is just to convict him. They don't care that he's not guilty of anything. They've set this whole thing up so that they can execute him. That's all they care about. So notice his answer. "If I tell you, you won't believe me. And if I ask you, you won't answer me." So he just doesn't really deal with the question. So then notice, though, as he says, well, here's what you're going to see. What a declaration. You're going to see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power of God. There's no doubt that he really, even though he's not answering their question, he's answering their question. He's saying, "Let me tell you what's going to happen. You're going to get to see it. You're going to get to see me, the Son of Man, sitting at God's right hand." Now, the way we know that that's what they understood that to be saying, they understood Jesus to be saying, "You're going to see me sitting next to God on His right hand." Because we notice their response in verse 70. "Then they said," all said, "Are you then the Son of God?" They understood. Now, he did not say the word Son of God anywhere in that statement. But then they said, "Well, wait a minute. You're saying we're going to see the Son of Man on the right hand. Are you saying you're the Son of God then? Is that what you're saying?" That's what they understood him to be saying. That is what he was saying. And then his response to them is a little awkward, certainly at least in the King James. It's not the way we would say it, but the King James just says, he said to them, ye say that I am? I've heard this said a number of different ways, because where you put the emphasis makes a big difference in this statement. Some people will say, he's saying, you say that I am. You're saying that I am. I didn't say that, you're saying that. This is the inflection that is used by those that say, well, Jesus never claimed to be the Son of God. Then there are others who will say, no, what he said here was, you say that I am. He's just saying, you know, you're making that accusation against me. But really, what's actually happening here would be closer to what you said, that's what I am. You say that I am. And so that's really closer to what's happening. He's basically finally acknowledging, yes, I am the Son of God. You finally got it right. Because they'd asked about the Christ, they asked about the Messiah, but the Jews still had this idea of a Christ or a Messiah that was a human being, like David, like an Elijah, somebody who had the power of God working through it, but it was just a man. When they finally get down to, wait, are you saying you're the Son of God? Then he says, now you got it. That's what I am. That's what you're finally understanding, what I've been trying to teach you. And so they finally get it, but of course they don't get it. They all understood the way that this was worded and the way these things were going, much more certainly than we would, because they were native speakers of the language. It's, you know, there are some idioms, some phrasing that goes on there that we just don't understand with our English language, that they would have understood with their understanding of their language. And there are many things like that in the Bible that, while we can kind of get the gist of it in English, we miss some of the deeper meaning sometimes because of not knowing those original language words. Well, then in verse 71, they come to, well, this is what they've been wanting all along. In fact, this is what Caiaphas had gone for during the night trial before this one. That's what he had finally gotten. Oh, well, now we've heard him say it with our own ears. Now we know. He's blaspheming. He's saying he's the Son of God. And so now here they are again with the whole council this time, and he says much the same thing. And so they said, What need do we have for any further witnesses? For we ourselves have heard of his own mouth. So Jesus, you know, you realize they were trying to pin all sorts of things on him. They had tried to make him a violator of the Sabbath day, because then they would have the right to execute him according to the law of Moses. But he had destroyed every argument that they had about that. They had tried to entrap him in his words to actually say something against the Roman government so that they could use that against him. But of course he had expertly twisted that around on them too, so that they just couldn't trick him, they couldn't trap him. All of the time they've been trying to do these things. Finally, they come to their conclusion, to their verdict of he's guilty and he deserves to die for it. But the crime that he's been found guilty of, he pushed them to this. This is where he drove them. The crime that he's being convicted of is being the Son of God. They finally come to the conclusion that the Son of God deserves to die. Now, not a one of them could disprove him being the Son of God. Not a one of them had even any grounds on which to question whether he was the Son of God legitimately. But that was the conviction. Now, we'll notice later on when they get over to Pilate, they kind of change the rules a little bit. They make up some different accusations that are not actually what they convicted him of, which shows again the lack of morals and ethics and just human decency that these people have. They are so corrupt they are so twisted by their desire for power and their desire to have things their way that they just can't see straight to being honest about anything. But Jesus had finally forced them to find Him guilty and convict Him to death based on Him being their Messiah. They had finally acknowledged, okay, so you're the Messiah, you're the Son of God, we don't want you, we want to kill you. That's what that really came down to. We don't want a Messiah, we don't want God's Son, we want to kill Him. It's interesting, isn't it? That's exactly what Jesus said would happen when He was telling the parable of the renters of the vineyard. Remember that? The fellow owned the vineyard and the people wouldn't send their payments to him. And so he sent messenger after messenger, and some of them they'd beat and some of them they'd kill. And finally he said, well, I'm going to send my own son. And so he sent his own son. He said, surely they'll respect my son. But when his son got there, you know what they said? Oh, wait. This is the heir. If we kill him, we get to keep it. Now that's the kind of twisted logic that some human beings use sometimes. But they thought if they killed the son, the heir, that then they would inherit the vineyard? Really? So they killed him. And Jesus asked the question, what do you suppose the vineyard owner is going to do? Is he going to take kindly to them killing his son, murdering his son? Is he going to let them inherit that vineyard? No, he's not going to let them live on that vineyard another day. He is going to take them and remove them and give that to somebody else. The Jews all got mad at him at that time. Why? Because they knew he was talking about them. And yet even knowing that he gave that parable, told that about God and God sending his son and they were going to reject him, and then that's exactly what they did. Just what he said they'd do. They saw the son coming and they said, let's get rid of him and we can hang on to our power. Not realizing, of course, that by getting rid of him, they were going to turn God against them. And he would become their enemy and he would destroy them. Now, God didn't destroy them for about 40 years. It was 70 AD before He destroyed Jerusalem, but He did destroy it. And they lost all that they thought that they were going to save, all that they thought they were going to keep. Do you remember what Jesus said? He that seeks to save his life will lose it. They were seeking to save it, and they lost it because they wouldn't listen to Jesus. In several of the passages in the Scriptures, in the Gospels, the accusation that's made is, He made Himself to be the Son of God. He made Himself out to be the Son of God. Well, no, He didn't make Himself out to be the Son of God. He simply lived the life that the Son of God would live. He performed miracles. He did the things which no other man could do. He taught the things that no other man could teach. And He lived the life, the perfect sinless life that no other man could live. And they hated Him for every minute of it. And they destroyed Him because of it. The Sanhedrin is finally forced to face that issue. But when they come before Pilate, of course, we'll see next time, it's a different story. That's not the claim that they make. You think it would have gone differently had they come to Pilate and said, hey, we've got a guy here who claims to be the Son of God. We should kill him. Now, Pilate, being a Roman and believing in gods and believing, you know, if you've ever read Greek mythology, there were all kinds of people who were descended from the gods, where, you know, one of these gods would fall in love with a human woman and they'd have a child like a Hercules. There were all sorts of stories like that in the Roman myths. He would have been scared to death to think about executing the Son of a God. He probably wouldn't have done it. So, of course, they changed their tactic and they lied to him just like they lied to everybody else along the way. But after they finally had said, "We don't need any more witnesses. We've heard it from his own mouth. He claimed to be the Son of God. That's enough. We'll kill him for that." Now, obviously, if you or I or any of them had claimed, "I'm the Son of God," in the way that Jesus had claimed that, well, we would have been worthy of death. That would have been blasphemy. But they failed to take into account the fact that Jesus is the Son of God. And everything that he did proved it. But they just ignored that. So the whole multitude of them, Luke 23 and verse 1, arose and led him to Pilate. So probably they're going to get to Pilate's at about 7 o'clock. Maybe 6:30 if the sun rose a little early that morning, you know, as soon as they could get. But it didn't take them long, this one. They'd done all the all-night long stuff, but this trial before the Sanhedrin really didn't take long. They just really wanted him to say something, anything that they could accuse him with. But the only thing that he would say was the truth. So they had to convict him of guilt based on that truth. The Sanhedrin was as corrupt as their leader. Now that's not to say that there was no one in the Sanhedrin that was honorable. We know about Nicodemus. We know that there were some others that spoke up occasionally. But as soon as they did, boy, they were shouted down. On one occasion they said, "Wait, does our law condemn a man before he's been judged?" And they said, "What's wrong with you? Where are you from? Nazareth too? No prophets ever came from there. He can't be a prophet." They just jumped all over the guy that questioned it. You know, the religious world today is not a whole lot different sometimes. Anyone who questions their authority or their way of seeing something, everybody just jumps all over them. "How dare you say that? What's wrong with you? You're some sort of heretic or something." Anytime that we suggest something different from what the mainstream denominational world says, "Are you part of a cult or something?" "Yeah, I'm part of a cult that believes in following Jesus. A sect that believes that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and that He came and lived and died for me, and that He left the Scriptures written by inspiration of God to tell me what He wanted me to do, and that I have to live by them and not by the rules of a council like the Sanhedrin or some other ruling council of some religious body, but that I have to live according to the Scriptures, the Bible, the Word of God." And if that makes us members of a cult or a sect, then maybe that's what we should be. That's what the first century Christians were accused of when they said that, they're part of this sect. That's what they were really saying, is they're part of a cult. There's something wrong with them. They're not normal. They're weird. There are worse things in the world than being weird. The worst thing in the world is being lost. If you're here this evening and you have not confessed that Jesus is the Son of God, as was admitted to by Christ even, as He stood there and said, "You said I am. That's what I am." If you haven't confessed that, you need to confess that. Perhaps you say, "Well, I confessed that a long time ago before I was baptized." Are you daily confessing it with the way you live your life? You see, confession of Christ is not a one-time verbal thing that we do before we're baptized. We do that, but that's not the end of confessing Christ. Confessing Christ is day in and day out living as though He is the Son of God, and He is our Lord and Savior. Are we living that way? Or, when push comes to shove, are we really denying it like the Sanhedrin Council did? If you need to respond to God's invitation at this time for any reason, please do so as we stand and as we sing.